Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books on Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jenny Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today is Dr. Susan Klang with her new book, Dancing the Dharma, Religious and Political Allegory in Japanese Noir Theater. It was published earlier this year by Harvard Asian Center as a volume of the Harvard East Asian Monograph series. Dr. Klang is a professor of Japanese literature and culture at the University of California, Irvine. So this book discusses the theory and practice of allegory in noir plays of medieval Japan. Noir is a kind of dance drama that has been practiced since 14th century Japan. They usually adopt stories and themes from classical tales and myths and poetry. And as Susan argues, they also pay very careful attention to the historical context of each play through allegory. So welcome, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I know you have been studying noir plays for quite a while, and you have written before on allegory. What aspects of noir plays intrigue you so much, and how did this study of noir and allegory emerge and evolve?
So first of all, you should know, I'm one of those great examples of someone who didn't know anything about Japan before I ended up teaching English in Japan for 2 years. I barely knew where Japan was. I'd taken one or two classes in college, but basically I spoke no Japanese, and I got a job teaching English in Japan by accident. So I didn't start learning Japanese until I was 24 or 25 years old. So it is possible to do this. most people nowadays, they start in high school or, you know, the latest in college, or they come from a native language background. But a couple of weeks after I arrived in Japan, I met someone at a coffee shop, an American, who was very, very interested in no theater. And he invited me to go see a no play. And he went two or three times a month to see no. And so I said, sure, why not? And I went along. And because at that time I was very interested in modern dance and modern art, I was also had a very strong interest, I should say, in medieval religion and literature. So it was a kind of strange combination. But because I was so interested in modern dance, it did not bother me even slightly when I went to see a no play that, in fact, I understood nothing of what was going on. I had like a little synopsis of the play, but beautiful costumes, gorgeous dance movements, really interesting, syncopated, almost jazz-like music, that fierce, otherworldly flute. And the other thing that I really found enthralling, well, it wasn't enthralling exactly, but I loved to draw. And for long periods of time, in a no play, when the chorus is chanting or something else is going on, the characters, the actors are immobile on the stage. They don't move for a long period of time. So it's great for drawing. And I think for that reason, whereas most people get bored in no, most Americans or Europeans, English-speaking people who don't know anything about Japanese culture, they get very bored. And I didn't get bored because I was drawing. And so, and also, as I said, I love modern dance. So I was not bothered at all by not really understanding what was going on. I just loved the spectacle and the rich spectacle of it. And I kept going back and to draw and to listen and to watch. And the more I went back, the more interested I got in it. And I started trying to find out about it and read about it. And that's how I got interested in Noh, really. I would not have told you, believe me, it would be the last thing that I would have told you in college that I was going to end up spending my professional life on. So after I left Japan and went back to New York City, I worked in the art world for a couple of years. I was I worked at the Whitney Museum of Art. I worked for the Japan Society, going around and interviewing professional artists in New York City. And then at a certain point, I decided that I didn't really want to do modern art, that it really wasn't what I was interested in, that I really didn't want to do this. And I started looking around for graduate programs. And I ended up going to Cornell University, where Karen Brazell was. And I went for two reasons. One, they gave me a year of studying Japanese intensively, which obviously I needed. And then Karen Brazell was the foremost Noh professor. She was really very much into performance, but she was the foremost Noh professor in the United States. And so I felt very privileged to be able to go and get to study with her. And I had thought maybe I would get a master's and then go someplace else and do art history. But it turned out that I loved Noh so much. And it integrated so much of what I liked about Noh, about Japanese culture, the music, the art, the dance. And then it turned out to have just extraordinarily interesting literature. Like the literary aspects of Noh turned out to be right up my alley. Weird esoteric cults and strange initiations, which is what I loved about medieval European religion as well. I was very into Gnosticism. And very complicated punning structures that you had to spend a lot of time interpreting. All of this just like rang my bells. I was just like, yes, 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 yes. and so that's how I ended up being a Noh scholar. And I went back to Japan and on a Fulbright and studied with Mitani Kuniaki at Yokohama Shiuritsu Daigaku, Yokohama University, and spent a year studying commentaries with him. And then Teriyama Shuichi, who was a professor in Kobe, came to Cornell and spent a year there on a Fulbright. And he also worked with me on commentaries. And that's how I was actually able to do the relationship of commentaries and Noh. And I should say, the reason why I got interested in commentaries and Noh is that it was just timing. Ito Masayoshi published his three-volume collection of Noh plays, the Yokyokushu. He published it right around the time that I was beginning graduate school. And my first year of taking classical Japanese, Karen Brazell said, I want you to translate Kakitsubata, which is, you would translate it as the iris. Kakitsubata is a kind of Japanese iris. I want you to translate Kakitsubata, and I want you to translate it using Ito Masayoshi's Yokyokushu. Ito Masayoshi was the first person, the first Japanese scholar, to really try to show how this group of medieval allegorical commentaries, which developed in the 13th and 14th century in Japan, had been used to write Noh plays. And nobody had previously paid any attention to it at all. It was just like they didn't exist. And he showed how these commentaries were appearing again and again in the plays. And they are especially central to the play Kakitsubata. And that's how I got interested in the problem of allegory. And in the problem of allegorical commentaries and the relationship to Noh was through translating Kakitsubata and writing a very, very long paper and analyzing Kakitsubata. And that became the central chapter of my dissertation. So, like I said, I went back to Japan in the Fulbright because nobody knew anything about allegorical commentaries at the time, really. I went back to Japan and I studied the commentaries Mitani Kuniaki and again with Tara. Terashima Shoichi. Again, it was a crazy thing to have done. None of the commentaries were annotated. It was just completely bonkers that I even attempted it. But my dissertation ended up being 500 pages, right? because I felt like I had to do the development of the allegorical first I had to do, what is the problem of allegory in Japanese literature? Then I had to do the development of allegorical commentaries. Then I had to do, how do the commentaries show up in no plays? And then I had a bunch of translations. And obviously 500 pages is too long for a book. So my dissertation advisor said, split it up. You're going to do a book on development of allegorical commentaries, and you're going to do a book on the effect of commentaries on the no plays. So I did manage to get the book on the development of commentaries written in a timely fashion, at least in time to get me tenure. And so that was published in 2003. But in 2002, I had my first daughter. And in 2005, I had my second daughter. And somehow it took me until this year to get the second half of that dissertation published. And in fact, I expanded it an enormous amount. The book as it is published now is nothing like what the only thing that really remains from the dissertation is that central chapter on Kakitsubata. But otherwise, it's much, much, much expanded, including work on plays related. The central thing about Kakitsubata is it's related to Tales of Issei and the commentaries on Tales of Issei or Issei Monogatari, which is a 10th century poem tale. And then, but I expanded my book to include also commentaries and plays on the first imperial poetry anthology, the Kokin Wakushu. I think that answers your question, right?
Yes. No, that's such an inspiring story. I think even now there are a lot of non-Japanese speakers who go to Japan and be attracted, be intrigued by elements of the Japanese culture, usually popular culture. Some might be interested in no joruri kind of stage performance as well, and they are always jokingly referred to as weebs. Mm-hmm. But it's just so inspiring to see how this love for these elements can turn into a lifelong career.
Very interesting. No one else that I knew in Japan, that I was with in Japan at the time with, nobody else followed this path. I definitely went down my own, primrose path, for sure.
Yeah, that definitely takes a lot of determination.
Especially since my Japanese, and that's the thing is, of course, now I read classical Japanese extremely well, and my spoken Japanese is still, it's okay, but it's still not what it should be, considering that I've been doing this for 40 years. And that's just because I spend all my time reading. And I have gotten to go back to Japan on a number of occasions. So I'm not saying that I didn't get to do that, but that's always like, it's just a slight bit of, but so it's like I've met Japanese scholars who were specialists in, Shakespeare. And, it's like, if I try to, sometimes when I'm speaking, they're looking at me like, Are you saying gazooks? it's that kind of response. Like you're using some kind of bungo-esque, thing that you shouldn't be doing because you read.
Yes. Well, that's.
But no, it's been a wonderful career. I cannot complain about it. I've enjoyed every moment of it.
Yeah, that's the advantage of it. So for our readers who might not be so familiar with Nolt plays, can you give an overview of what Nolt play is and how it developed through the centuries and, more importantly, how it connects with literature?
Okay, well, we can try to do that. I talked a little bit about my first impression of Nolt, and it is this amazing combination. Well, first of all, it's not spoken at all. There's no spoken component of it, right? So it's very different from, it's more like a musical than than a play, but it's nothing like musicals that you think of because it's more like opera. Actually, let's say it's more like opera in the sense that it combines chanting and dance and music. Then the music is contrapuntal; it's not syncopated, and an extraordinarily dense poetic text. Right, gorgeous, gorgeous costumes. Very, very simple stage. They all performed at an extremely simple stage, just a bare, it looks like the an outdoor performance stage at a, in the temple. There's just a very simple backdrop of a pine tree. They have got the most basic of props and the most basic of larger props that would indicate, for example, a tomb or a temple or, you know, just very, very, very simple, but at the same time, so elegant and so beautiful. So that's, and it's also the place that I'm interested in especially, which tend to be what are called dream vision Knoll, they tend to also be fairly spare in terms of the characters. There's one main character, usually. Sometimes there's a secondary character that's attached to the main character. And there's one interlocutor. And the main character is called the Shte, and the interlocutor is called the Waki. Oftentimes the Waki is a traveling priest who's just happened by a shrine or a temple or some special place. And a local person appears, and it turns out it's a ghost, or it could be a deity. But it appears as a local village person, and then in fact it turns out that they are this ghost who is needing help from the traveler. They need their prayers to be released from some attachment, deep, passionate attachment to the past. Either if they're a warrior, right, it's their death. You know, they died in battle and they need help getting out of the warrior hell. If it's a beautiful woman, often a beautiful woman, they're attached to some long ago lost love. And in order to get free of that attachment, they reenact the past for us. And the reenactment in itself seems to be cathartic, plus the prayers of the priest combined. And they are hopefully, but not always, released from their attachment. And that's just one. There's other kinds of no plays. There's no plays that are based in the present. There's no plays that are that are about possession and exorcisms. They're very exciting. Exorcism ritual, no plays like Aoi no Wei or Dojoji, the serpent, a story about a woman who turns into a fiery serpent because of angry jealousy. Those plays are actually the most fun for a foreigner to see because they're exciting and spectacular. But the plays that I tend to be interested in have a lot more complicated poetry and a lot more layered quality to them. They tend to be these simpler dream vision Knolls. There's always a chorus alongside. The chorus doesn't, it's not like a Greek chorus where they speak, where they comment on the action. They tend to be speaking for the characters, especially when the characters are dancing. The main character is dancing. The chorus speaks for the character, and it's kind of this very strange first person, third person confusion, which is possible because classical Japanese doesn't clearly distinguish between first and third person. And then there's musicians along the back. There's usually two or three drummers and a flute player. Not like kabuki where there's a shamisen player or any kind of stringed instrument. It's all drum and flute. So it's a very different kind of sound than people are used to if they're used to listening to Japanese shamisen, for example. And there's also minor characters often played by kyogen actors who are the comedic version of performance. And sometimes you get child actors in there as well. But I think as I said, it's all chanted. And another interesting thing about it, but no, let's just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, it certainly sounds very exciting from your description. I've never seen a Knoll play when I was in Japan, but I heard this joke that my Japanese friends were telling me, if you have insomnia, you should go to a Knoll play so that you can actually get some sleep because it's so slow. But we know, Dr. Pennington and Dr. Knoll Pennington kept telling me that was not the case.
Yeah, I don't know how anyone could sleep through that piercing flute. It is so loud. But the whole point of some stories in Knoll is that it that there's actually, like, for example, Dojoji, the whole middle part of Dojoji is supposed to be inducing a trance on the people on, it's a dance performed to induce a trance. And in fact, it's absolutely riveting. It doesn't induce trance at all. But I have had Japanese friends who go to know and would sort of drift off and say and claim that they would best understand that they got the dream vision effect of no precisely because they were slightly falling asleep during it. I don't know.
That sounds like a great way to be immersed.
But as I said, you know, one of the reasons why it didn't bother me that there was long periods of time where nothing seemed to be happening on stage was because I was drawing. And that enabled me to sort of push through that boredom that people experience when they first see no, and they don't understand what the chorus is saying, and they don't, and then nothing appears to be happening on stage. So I was lucky that way. I had a way through. And then once I really understood the literature and the literary aspects of it, it was fine. I love no. And oh, the other real thing that most people in the audience in a no play, most people in the audience study no. They study the chanting, utai, and they study the dance performance, the shimai. And so they come to a no performance, maybe of their teacher, right? They come to it having studied the chanting and the dance, right? So it's a completely different experience because they're watching a professional actor chant and dance, something that they know that they perform themselves. And I think that is a really different experience. And it makes it a lot more interesting. There are also people who have a libretto in their hand, what's called a nutaibono, a chanting book. And they're actually just sort of looking down at the libretto and then looking up and looking down at the libretto and looking up. And I think they're not experiencing it quite as well. But I think there is this wonderfully immersive quality to being in a no play, watching a no play, particularly if you've actually studied it, the performance of it. And that's something that's so unusual as a performance art, truly. How many performing arts are there, or traditions are there in the world where you can study how to do it, right? You can study the chanting and the dance. It's undoubtedly not exactly like it was, you know, in 1400 or 1500 or 1600, but nevertheless, you know, you can study it. It's a continuous performance tradition, and that's an amazing thing. And some of my best experiences in Japan were studying various, you know, setting the plays that I actually worked on. I learned all the plays that I worked on.
That is amazing. And hopefully after our listeners listen to this episode and read your book, when they go to a no play, they can try to identify these little elements that you mentioned.
Well, nowadays too, if you go to a National No Theater, they actually have English subtitles in the chair in front of you, right? When I went first, there was nothing. There was nothing. There wasn't even any English translations of the plays that I was watching. But now they've got subtitles. And so it's very much like watching opera in Italian. You can see what's going on as you're watching it very easily. It's a completely different, a much better experience, I think.
Yeah, that's very nice. So the center of your argument in this book is allegory. I've read a lot of scholars of Japanese literature talking about allegory in poetry. And since poetry existed almost everywhere in pre-modern Japanese literature, it inevitably appeared in no plays as well, since no plays drew inspiration from literature. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about what kinds of poetry and, more importantly, what elements of such poetry would appear in no plays, and how did these poems or their composers use allegory when they got incorporated into these no plays? Were they used in similar ways when they comparing to the original poems?
Okay. So I'm really interested in this idea that you, or what you said about having read a lot of scholars of Japanese literature talking about allegory and poetry. And I think that's because you're a Bunjin specialist. Because believe me, especially when I was getting started in this, in the far reaches of time, the 1980s, nobody was talking about allegory in poetry or no. In fact, it was very much the opposite. New criticism was still the dominant way of thinking about poetry and literature. And even as we moved into deconstructionist and post-structuralist ways of thinking about poetry and literature, there still was this very strange kind of push against historicism, right? Which made it difficult to think about allegory. It really did. And so that was the situation that I was in the 80s. It's very different from the situation today, completely different world. And so really, I felt compelled in my dissertation to spend the whole first chapter, and actually I spent one of my entire qualifying exams, on sort of creating this genealogy of the sort of symbiotic relationship of allegory and symbol, and how allegory became devalued and symbol got pushed up, and then how at the moment when it's really the rhetoric of temporality, right? That this really very famous essay that reverses that allegory symbol valuation, and it's at that moment actually that allegory becomes sort of preeminent trope of trope, and symbol gets pushed to the side in post-structuralist and then obviously in new historicist thinking, because symbolism tends to be universal. Its appeal is that it's universal. Its appeal is that you can easily understand it without having to know a lot of very specific details. Whereas allegory demands historical context. It demands an understanding of the religious and political and economic and social situation in which a play or piece of poetry is performed. And that really is very, very different. And so, my dissertation was a polemical argument for that. And on some level, although the situation is completely different, new historicism really came to the forefront of literary history literary history as a field became very dominant in the pre-modern field by the 90s, right? So when I published my book, Allegories of Desire, in 2003, it was already almost past the point where you needed to even make an argument for allegory. Nevertheless, I felt like in this book as well, I needed to actually talk about how allegory in Japanese literature, especially poetry, and in no, is in some ways significantly different from allegory as it is understood in Western literature. And I wanted to make an argument for allegory as a trope that made sense for Japanese literature. So that said, a big difference between Western allegory and Japanese allegory is that Western allegory allegory really develops an allegoresis, allegorical commentary, develops in kind of a reverse order. Allegorical commentary comes into existence in biblical exegesis, where New Testament scholars are trying to make sense of the Old Testament and trying to bring it into, make them work together. And to do that, they have to use allegorical readings that clearly did not make sense in terms of the original meanings of the text, right? And then from the development of allegorical commentaries, we then moved to political and we moved to religious allegory in texts, in fiction or in other kinds of texts. It doesn't work quite. In Japanese literature, we start with political and religious allegory, and allegorical commentaries do not come into existence until the medieval period. So it's also a kind of reversal. It doesn't quite work the same way. But we clearly have examples of political and religious allegory in the 9th and 10th century, in the Kokin Wakashu, for example, the first imperial poetic anthology. We also see it very much in the Manyoshu, which is the previous large collection of Japanese poetry. And so you'll get a religious allegory. For example, William O'Fleur, in one of his articles on Buddhism in Japanese literature, gives an example of a poem that's really a witty allegory on the Lotus Sutra, which was the preeminent sutra, Buddhist sutra, in the Heian period. This is the 8th to 11th centuries, 9th to 11th centuries in Japan. And there's this notion in the Lotus Sutra of the three vehicles, vehicles that will get you to enlightenment, right? And it also has this parable called about the burning house, and another parable called the impartial rain, right? And so all of these tropes, these stories, are everybody in this period would know what the three vehicles were. They'd know the impartial rain. They would understand that in relation to Lotus Sutra. So we have a woman who's going with a bunch of friends to go hear a Lotus Sutra lecture, right? And they go in the three of them go in separate carriages, but then there's some kind of huge rainstorm and something happened to the other two carriages and they all had to climb into the same carriage, the one carriage, and they reach the hall successfully, right? And in the Lotus Sutra, the idea is that there's three possible vehicles to enlightenment, but only one vehicle is the Mahayana vehicle, the big vehicle, the one that's going to actually get you there, right? And so you should believe in the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And so they write a poem that says, our party rode out in three vehicles, but all of us got dampened in the impartial rain. So it's a joke, right? It's a joke. It's a witty joke, but it completely depends on your understanding, on an understanding of the Lotus Sutra, which anybody reading the poem would have known, right? But listen to how long it took me to explain the poem. That's the problem with religious allegory. That's the problem with allegory, is it takes this extraordinary apparatus of explanation for someone who doesn't just know off the top of their head what the Lotus Sutra is. In order to make it for it, and by the time you're finished, does it seem funny? Probably not, right? So this is my entire book. It's nothing but footnotes explaining complicated puns and trying to set the historical context for it. So yes, some people are going to say, okay, stop. But there's religious allegory, and then there's also political allegory. And political allegory tended to be, hey, I want a promotion, or hey, I'm a court poet working for this patron and I want to celebrate a special, their birthday or somebody's coming of age ceremony. And I'm going to write an allegorical poem that refers to it through, various kinds of natural images. And maybe it'll get me preference. maybe it'll get me a promotion. So there's that kind of political allegory as well. And that's everywhere. You see it everywhere in the Heian period. What's different when you get to the medieval period is you start getting allegorical commentaries. And these are these very strange commentaries, which were influenced by a heretical, became heretical, but at the time, when they first developed, it was not heretical, right? This sect of Shingon Buddhism that basically argued that you could achieve enlightenment through sex. And it did this, and it was promoted by someone named Fujiwara Tamiaki, who lived in the late 13th century. He was a Shingon priest, and he was a member of the Fujiwara family of poetry, the foremost poetry family at the time. But he was kind of pushed out of his patrimony because his mother wasn't favored by his father, Fujiwara Tamiie. So he goes off to Kamakura and creates this whole elaborate initiation system and all of these allegorical readings of tales of Issei and the Kokin Wakashu, which initiate you into these secret meanings and the religious meanings of that. And Tales of Issei, I should say, is a poem tale that follows the man of old, right? Which very soon after it was written was understood to be a particular person, Adiwara no Narihira, who lived in the 9th century. And it was understood as a kind of secret biography of all of his relationships with women and the poetry that he wrote in terms of all these secret relationships with women. And so the commentary comes in, these allegorical commentaries come in the 13th century and say, oh, Narihira just isn't a ladies' man and a great, great, great poet. He's actually the Bodhisattva of song and dance. He's a manifestation of the kami of yin and yang, i.e. of sex. He's actually ultimately Dainichi Nyorai, the ultimate deity of Shingon Buddhism. And if we just initiate you and you pay lots and lots of money, if you initiate you into these higher and higher levels of esoteric, you know, understanding, you will understand the true meaning of Tales of Ise. Right. This is the crazy stuff that I saw I got really, really interested in. And, you know, these commentaries were very secret for about 100 years. And then they start disseminating out into the world, they start becoming less secret. The sect, which is known now as Tachikawa, but probably wasn't the same as the actual Tachikawa sect at the time. But at any rate, it's easier to just call it the Tachikawa sect. It was declared heretical. And so basically what happens but these commentaries are used by no composers to write plays. And Kompaoru Zenchiku is the sort of central composer in my book. He really was interested in these commentaries, and he was very interested in the methodology that they used. And so my argument really is that Zenchiku uses that methodology of allegoresis as a means of composing the no plays. And if you understand if you understand that methodology and that worldview, that understanding of how the signifier-signified relationship works, that the relationship between the signifier and signified is not arbitrary, which is what everybody posts in the 20th century believes, right? Linguistics has taught us that the signifier, the word and its referent are arbitrary. Their relationship is arbitrary. If you believe that it's non-arbitrary, and that if you can analyze kanji or puns or visual images to show that they will actually analyze a kanji into its component parts, it will tell you something about the true reality, something really important about the world. And you can see that way of thinking for Zenchiku, both in one of his most important commentaries from my perspective, Meishikushu, where he uses that methodology really extensively, and then in his plays. I think I've gone sort of all around and off and down. But the point here is that in the Han period, you've got this straightforward political and religious allegory. It gets very interesting and strange in the medieval period. Religious commentaries have a very important influence. I argue that these allegorical commentaries have an important influence on a certain subset of no plays. But the other problem here for political allegory, well, actually, I'll finish that other thought first, that the problem with the religious allegory influence on the no plays is that religious stuff, the Shingon Tachikawa, is declared heretical. And by the Edo period, it's pretty much suppressed. Right. And in the modern period, nobody wants to have anything to do with it. They don't want to even, they really like, they sort of just don't want to admit that it exists. Right. And it is only with the 1960s, with Mitani Kuniaki and then Ito Masayoshi, who really bring these commentaries back out and say, look at this, is everywhere in the medieval period. This kind of thinking is not just in these weird allegorical commentaries. You see it in religious texts of all kinds. Because what they were trying to do with those allegorical, this allegoresis, this methodology, is they're trying to bring together Shingon Buddhism or Buddhism generally, yin-yang, omyodo, you know, and kami worship, what's now known as Shinto, right? And they're trying to bring these into congruence, and this allegorical methodology really works to do that, right? So basically what Ito Masayoshi says is, hey, look at these commentaries are there. And then my whole book is trying to understand how it works, right? And there's other people who've done this. So I'm talking a really, really long time for this one question, but I got to go back to talk about political allegory. And the problem with political allegory is that most of, so we understand how religious allegory was erased from these plays. And New Criticism especially was really disliked allegory. So it was not interested in trying to find allegory in the plays because, you know, but political allegory, the problem with political allegory is that the plays were, they were almost undoubtedly written for specific patrons in specific performance contexts, right? And they almost undoubtedly had very specific political points. But because they've been lifted out of that historical context and we have so little information about when a play was first performed and who it was composed by, it's almost impossible to figure out what the political meaning of the play was. And as it happens, the two plays that are absolutely clear, at least from my perspective, are Oshio, which we know was performed in, we just happen to know, was first performed in 1465 by Zenchiku, right? Before Ashikaga Yoshimasa, right? We know the exact moment it was written, who it was performed for, and who it was composed by. And that enables us to read it politically, right? And another play that I talk about is Hakuraku Ten, maybe by Zayami, probably written by Yoshimasa's, probably written for Ashikaga Yoshinori in about 1420-21, after, again, aimed at a specific political event that happened, right? But this is, it's very unusual for us to know when and where a play was written. So erasing the politics was very easy. And when these plays are moved into the Edo period, there was a lot of reason to erase the politics. You wanted to take that play and make it universal. And in the case of Oshio, it's really interesting. Oshio was originally performed under the title Ohara no Hanami, or flower viewing, cherry blossom viewing at Ohara no. And it was performed 4 months after, it was a command performance before Ashikaga Yoshimasa, right? The most powerful shogun, the shogun, right? It was performed 4 months after Yoshimasa and his entire entourage had done this extraordinarily spectacular and very, very, very expensive cherry blossom viewing procession that ended at Ohara no Shrine, right? And so Zenchiku very, very cleverly uses a story from Tales of Issei about Ariwara no Narihira and his lover, Fujiwara no Takaiko, right, who was the Nijo Empress at the time, but they supposedly had an illicit relationship when they were young. He creates this play, which basically is a celebration of Yoshimasa's cherry blossom festival, cherry blossom viewing procession, directly pointing to it in so many different ways. And we would never know that if we didn't know that it was performed 4 months after it. And within two years, the Onin Civil War happens. 10 years of horrific civil war destroys Kyoto. And Yoshimasa is very much blamed for this civil war, right? And the command performance in 1465, plus the cherry blossom viewing thing from 4 months, are considered grave sins by Yoshimasa because of their extravagance. So not surprisingly, 10 years later, when the Komparu troupe, and this is now Zenchiku's grandson, wants to reinstate that play into the troupe repertoire, does he call it Ohara no Hanami? No, he does not. He calls it Oshio. And he just tries to pretend it had nothing to do with Yoshimasa. And that's basically the sort of trajectory for most of these no plays. Even if they had a political meaning originally, they've lost it. You know, we don't know what it is. And it just happens that because that particular command performance of the four main no troops happened to be so important that it got noted down in somebody's diary, we would never know. We just wouldn't know. But my argument is that there are probably a number of other plays that we can figure this out for, that we can try to figure out the politics. But so the allegory both political and religious just gets erased from No for various reasons. And my whole book is trying to reinstate the historical context for the plays, the religious context for the plays, and try to show how when we read them in those contexts, we actually can understand the plays in a way that, you know, otherwise they just seem to be kind of boring about cherry blossoms and the beneficence of a deity and who cares. Anyway, I'm trying to make them seem, I think they're more interesting when we read them that way. I guess that's what it
is. So what you said was absolutely fascinating. And I actually prepared these questions to connect the different parts of your book, but I think your answer just made a perfect narrative for how the two most important themes of your allegory worked throughout, not only in the not plays but also the commentaries of it. So I guess to move on to the next question, what I like most about your book is that you don't treat Knorr simply as a piece of literary work, nor as stage performance alone, but a part of the changing entity of texts that were influencing each other and taking inspirations from each other. Are there any changes from the early stage of Knorr to later periods in how they use other texts, how they incorporating commentaries, or even other Knorr plays?
So I think I sort of answered part of this in my previous answer, my rambling answer. But as I said, I suspect most early Knorr was written for a specific patron in a specific performance context. And over time, those contexts were erased. And then the plays sort of float free of their historical origins. But that was extremely useful for the Tokugawa family in the Edo period. And the Tokugawa basically became the patrons for they designated four major no troops, and then they added the Kita school as well. So there became five major no troops that they patronized and supported. But part of that, you know, patronage was that they were not interested in political. Pretty much all the plays that were clearly political, right? Anything that really looked obviously political, that was dropped. They were dropped from the repertoire. And even things that were even slightly tinged with politics got dropped. So it was very important that these plays be modified or changed or smooth, all their rough edges or allegorical edges were smoothed out so that, you know, the little things that might tickle your ear, like Narihira is the bodhisattva of Kami and Yin and Yang. Where did that come from? Just sort of smoothly flows over you. Because the Tokugawa were really interested in using No as a kind of, not ritual theater in the sense of a religious ritual, but like a political theater that would support them and support their ideology. And so in that sense, No becomes this very elegant, very smooth. The performance aspects of it are standardized. It starts really in the late 16th century. It starts being taught. The utai and shimai, the dance, chanting and dance, begins to be taught to patrons, to audience members, non-professional people. And so it becomes important to standardize the performance and the troops also want to standardize their performances. So that they distinguish between the different kinds of troops. And people, Eric Rath wrote a book called Ethos of No, and Thomas Loser also wrote a book about the Edo period development of No. There's a number of other people who worked on the Edo period. And most of the texts that we have now and the texts that tell us what the performance aspects of it too are from the Edo period. So, you know, for performance people, we're kind of sort of trapped in that period. That's one reason why. And then in the modern period, there's a movement towards these plays that are that again, just there's no interest in plays that have any kind of political content, really. It's possible that a play like Hakurakuten, which foregrounds the Sumiyoshi deity as the martial defender of Japan against Bajuyi, who is the foremost Chinese poet, there's some possibility that that play might have been used as propaganda in the early 20th century, but most people don't want to talk about that. And in the early, in the post-war years, Hakurakuten becomes, sort of goes back to being just a poetry contest as opposed to having any kind of martial aspects to it. Even though Hakurakuten, the Sumiyoshi Daimyojin blows Bojui back to China with a kamikaze, you know, a divine wind, along with all the other Japanese deities. And proves the superiority of Japanese verse over Chinese. So yes, there's a little xenophobia there. Very surprising, actually, given how important Baoji is to Japanese literary history and poetry and how beloved he was. And that's actually one of the reasons that I got interested in Hakurakuten is because, and there's other Japanese scholars before me who absolutely have thought Hakurakuten had to be political. I'm not the first person who thought this at all. But it seemed very odd. And so oftentimes your instinct towards understanding allegory really comes, or looking for allegory comes from something that doesn't make sense in the play. That there needs to be an explanation for this. And that's exactly what the earliest scholars who were interested in this, including the historian from the early 20th century, said, no, this is the 1419 invasion of Tsushima by the Koreans. And the defense of they were raiding a bandit, a Wako pirate base in Tsushima, and that's what this play is actually about. Because it happened simultaneously with the Chinese envoy appearing off the coast of Osaka, and everybody thought the Mongol invasions were happening again. And so, in fact, Hakurakuten is this kind of lighthearted, after everything went away, after everything was resolved, it turned out to be a teapot, after all that was over, then they're like, oh, let's do this kind of funny no play making fun of the whole thing. And that's, but again, nobody would have thought about Hakurakuten as being political allegory, it was performed for hundreds of years. And nobody thought of it as political allegory. So am I answering your question?
Yes, that's absolutely fascinating.
I guess my basic point is that, up until fairly recently, and there's no Japanese scholar and there's almost no Western scholar now who doesn't think about historical context. What I thought I was doing that was unusual in the 80s is not even slightly unusual now. Everyone does it. So it's lovely for you to say that what I work do is innovative, but I feel like, I'm right there with everyone else doing, but it just happened to have a particular approach or a particular topic that has been very, very rich.
Yeah, but I think I absolutely loved your approach. And you mentioned this in your book too, that there was this period of, there were periods of different theoretical approaches were mainstream, which I thought I personally don't like those kind of seasonal trends, mm-hmm. because text literature or no plays, they're not closed. They cannot be fit into a seasonal fashion. But that's exactly why I loved your book, though, because you didn't try to take the seasonal fashionable methodology and make it, or let me go back a little bit. You didn't absolutely follow the seasonal trends.
I wouldn't want to say that my book isn't theoretically informed, because it is very theoretically informed.
Yes.
But I didn't try, but you're right. I didn't try to follow any particular theory and make that the focus. I The thing about theory is that it's very useful for understanding text, but you always have to read it against the grain because, of course, most theory is developed in the West, and we're talking about pre-modern Japanese literature. So it's you're gonna have to read it against the grain no matter what. And I think that's just true about all. That's all about all theory. It's just how we have to really. And I did try to interrogate the theories that I use. I think it's very important that we understand our particular moment and what our actual theoretical presuppositions are, so that we don't let them take over the object of our interest. It's almost impossible to not do that, but it's good to try to at least make an effort, right, to try to figure out where we are theoretically, so that we can see the object of our gaze at least as clearly as we can possibly can. And the other thing is that the text that I'm dealing with, especially the allegorical commentaries and the religious backing of them, are so excruciatingly difficult and complicated that if you added just another layer of theory on top of it, they would be impossible. So, you know, that made, for me, part of my job, and part of my job has been pretty much my entire career, is making these commentaries, these allegorical commentaries, actually make sense to people. That they weren't just gobbledygook, that it wasn't just nonsense, that there was a reason for them, that they made sense in their time, and that you can understand what the person who was writing them was trying to achieve. Now that's authorial intent, but you can't do new historicism, you can't do historical context without at least to a certain extent trying to recover what people meant by what they were writing. So you know, it's just important to understand where you are vis-a-vis those theoretical undercurrents and the theoretical fashions of the day. But you can't ignore them. And I worry that a lot of pre-modern scholars just say, oh, I don't have to deal with that because I'm working on pre-modern. I think it's best to really try to situate yourself vis-a-vis theory. But then you don't have to be overly dictated by it. You just have to need to be able to understand how you're using it. And that was my goal.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And actually, I usually save a big loaded question at the end for my guests, but you have already covered that. So let me just end this conversation with a quick, small one. Which not play is your favorite?
Okay, so I'm just obviously Kakitsubata, The Iris. It's okay. My favorite. It's the first play that I translated. I have been teaching it for 30 plus years. I teach it every year in Bungo. Whenever I teach classical Japanese, I teach Kakitsubata, which my students are not always that happy about. I know it so very well. And when I've learned the shima, I've learned the utai of the entire play. When I've seen Kakitsubata performed, and whenever I'm in Japan, I try to see it someplace. And it's a very popular play, so it's not impossible to see. I really feel like, because I know that play so very well, I'm having that kind of immersive experience that somebody in the audience in the medieval period would have had. I understand what they're saying as they're chanting it. I understand how the movement relates to the performance. I understand how this actor is doing it slightly different from that actor. It's an extraordinarily lovely thing to be able to do. And I can only do it with a very few plays. Oshio is another one. Hakuraku Ten is another one, because I've translated them and I know them really, really well. Onunin. But to be able to do that is such a huge pleasure. And also Kakitsubata is just I was very, very lucky to translate that as my first play. It is an extraordinarily beautifully written. There is nothing it's got to be one of his last plays. It is one of the most perfectly written no plays that there is. It's just, there's nothing out of place. Everything connects to everything else and everything builds on it. And so, like I said, I was very lucky that that was the first play I translated. If I translated, you know, something else, I might not have been so pulled into it. And it's still absolutely my favorite play. And it's a lovely play. It's about an iris. It focus. It's very strange. It focuses on an iris who believes a non-sentient plant who nevertheless appears as a beautiful young woman and has become obsessed with her position as the foremost flower representing Narihuara and Narihira, because she was an important part of one of his most famous poems. And she's absolutely like, everybody should be paying attention to me. My deep purple color is the most important deep purple color. Pay no attention to all those other female flowers. You know, it's me, me, me. And the arc of the play is that by reenacting Ariwara no Narihira's story as a bodhisattva and ultimately Dainichi Nodai, she understands that her position as an iris is not to be the emblem of his, you know, passionate attachment, but that in fact she can also achieve enlightenment, and along with all the other plants and grasses, take them with her to enlightenment, which is just a lovely, very strange, but very lovely idea that the nature is also it's also possible for nature to be enlightened and to bring us with it to enlightenment. And the poetry, the extraordinarily complicated poetry, the multi-level punning, and I haven't really talked about that. That was the one thing I haven't talked about here, is just the extraordinary punning and the level of analysis that has to go into these multiple layers of puns, which, you know, doesn't really exist. It exists to a certain extent in, like, Shakespeare, for example, in medieval literature. But it really is a special point. For no, and makes it for composers, for plays where the composer, like Senchiku, is really good at it, it's very, very fun. It makes the analysis very fun, especially for somebody like me who loves puzzles. I've always loved puzzles. And so that unlocking and unraveling, you can see me doing it in the book. Oh, yeah. Oh, look at this. Oh, look at this. Oh, look at this.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. And
it's a very exciting process, intellectual process.
And it definitely comes through. I was just listening to you talk about it. I was just so amazed by your passion and enthusiasm about these note plays. And I think it definitely comes out through your book as well.
Oh, I'm so glad that you got that from it. Because some of it was not so much fun. But most of it, all the analysis of the play, some of the analysis of the commentaries was kind of hard. But the analysis of the no plays was just pure pleasure. That was just so much fun to do. And I'm really very happy that I got to do it. And I hope I get to do more of it in the future.
Yes, yes. I'm definitely looking forward to reading more of it.
Great.
And thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. And for our listeners, to learn more about Allegory and Japanese knot plays, check out Susan Klein's Dancing the Dharma, Religious and Political Allegory in Japanese Knot Theater. This is Jingyi from New Books on Japanese Studies. I will see you in our next episode.